Have you ever been hungry? Maybe some of you haven't had food yet this morning, and you're thanking me right now for reminding you of that. But I don't mean like just missed a meal hungry. I'm talking about really hungry, like an extended period of time with no food. Maybe, you know, medical requirements, you can't eat anything for a time. You get to a certain age, you kind of know how these things go. But I was reflecting on probably the hungriest I have ever been. And I was 16 years old, and I was on what was called a trek, means a long, hard hike, in the mountains of New Mexico. I was with the scouts, so some of the people across the morning have been to that place, and they know what I'm talking about. And we hiked great distances most days, and we carried everything on our backs. So whatever we were going to wear, whatever we needed to make camp, and whatever we were going to eat. And we didn't pack 11 days worth of food on our backs the first day. We'd typically have about 3 days worth, and then when that ran out, we'd stop somewhere and get some more. So part of the deal was this was bear country. And the bears had figured out that it was a lot easier for them to eat the scouts' food than it was to eat as God had intended them to eat. And so we had to hang bear bags every night. And we were successful in hanging the bear bags. We would hear the bears in the camp, but we kept our food night after night after night. We get to the last night, and we had hung the bag exceptionally well that night. Like, we had two trees, and we put the bag, you know, in between them across a line. And this bear was very, very savvy. May have brought friends, you know, with him or her. But the best we could tell, they had climbed the tree and dropped down on the bag, and that was that. We could hear all this racket. The next morning we went, and there was no food left. And there was just not a morsel of food left. Well, every day we were blowing through so many calories just to try and, you know, keep up with the level of fitness demanded. We all lost weight, not just from that day, but, you know, across the track. And so we started off thinking, well, it's just one day. Well, one day when you're burning about 6,000 calories and eating zero, I mean, that's a lot. So by, you know, the midday, we never got to like hallucinating or anything, but we made a really poor decision. We started talking about food. Yeah, and it just didn't help, yeah. So we're talking about, oh, what are some of the best meals you've ever had? And when we get home, where are you going to go to eat? What's the first thing you're going to have? What's the first really good meal you're going to have? And kind of steak and Chicago pizza were neck and neck for, you know, most popular. And we learned, it's like when you're really, really hungry, thinking about food does not satisfy the hunger. I mean, if anything, it makes it worse. And remembering great meals that you've had when you're really, really hungry, that does not help either. And then I thought a little more this week, and sometimes we think about we analyze the nutritional content of our food. When you're really hungry, does it matter? I mean, does it really matter that you have, you know, the ideal mix of protein and carbohydrate and fat? And does it really matter that you've got the fat rightly apportioned between HDL and LDL cholesterol and simple and complex carbohydrates? I mean, it doesn't help. When you're really hungry, it's just give me food. I don't care. Another thing that doesn't matter when you're really, really hungry, that does not help sustain us, is considering the sources. So, you know, we might want to be eating locally sourced, humanely raised food. But what does it matter when you're really, really hungry? And the last one is, when you're really hungry, does it matter who pays for it? I mean, Maybe you pay for it. Maybe it's given to you. Maybe you swipe it. I knew a guy years and years ago, and he had grown up in a large city, single mom, just the two of them. She worked at minimum wage jobs and, you know, could not cover the cost of living every month. And he would more than occasionally go down to the corner fruit stand and, you know, swipe things to help supplement what mom was able to provide. I remember hearing that story and thinking, well, that was against the law. You know, says the guy who always had a refrigerator full of food. You know, desperate times call for desperate measures. The stories that I read to you a few moments ago were desperate times that called for desperate measures as well. You know, David was running for his life. Running for his life. He had left with nothing. And did you catch the story that he told Ahimelech the priest? Oh, I'm on a super secret mission. Saul has sent me on a super secret mission. No one can know about it. Well, he doesn't know who's for him and who's against him. Ahimelech turns out to help him out, but he didn't know that. Doeg, the guy who's just casually mentioned, he ends up ratting David out, you know, a few chapters down the line. So he tells him this story because desperate times call for desperate measures. I mean, there's something more important than being truthful here. There's also something more important than honoring the traditions and the expectations and the laws around who can eat what food. So what's referred to there is there were, I think it was a dozen, loaves of bread that were baked and set on the table in the tent of worship every day. And they were there as a sacrifice to God. But then when they were to be replaced the next day, the ones that had been there were to be consumed by the priests, and only the priests. So there's sacrifice, there's ritual, there's all this order, worship involved. And David just says, look, my guys and I, we're hungry. So we need 5 loaves of bread. Wherever you get them is up to you. And Ahimelech, also recognizing desperate times calling for desperate measures, gives him the loaves of the presence. And they eat them and go on their way. Well, this is the story that Jesus alludes to when he's confronted for some desperate measures taken during desperate times. David's disciples on the Sabbath are going through the field and they're hungry. And so what do? When they see food, they take it. But taking food there involves picking the heads of grain before they eat it. Now, if you know anything about the Pharisees, they're like vigilantes. I mean, you hear this story and you think, well, how improbable is that? I mean, would they have people stationed in every field, you know, just wondering what might happen? Well, no, what's happening instead is they're following and observing Jesus. The writer and priest N.T. Wright likens the Pharisees to the paparazzi of today. It's a pretty good comparison. So when you're in the grocery store and there's a line in front of you, your eyes might be drawn to the National Enquirer or some other fine publication, and you see the work of the paparazzi. You know? They make it their purpose to catch public and visible figures in compromising positions. And so also with Jesus, it's like they're just waiting. What's the compromising position today? Where and how can we find fault and challenge Jesus' legitimacy, not just to his face, but, you know, in the broader context? So Jesus, in answering them, tells the story or recalls the story of David and his men with the bread of the presence. Jesus says, effectively, desperate times call for desperate measures. There's something that's more important than following the letter of the law, and extreme hunger is one of those things that's more important. Clearly, there's precedent for this. It makes sense. And then he says one more thing. He says, the Son of Man, moi, is Lord of the Sabbath. Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Jesus knows that he is the anointed and rightful king, not only of Israel, but of all humanity. And the king makes the rules. The king sets the practice and the policy and tells the others how it's going to be. And Jesus, as king, as anointed yet not yet fully revealed king, Jesus, as that king on the last night of his life, put something in place and said, here's how it's going to be. He said, this is a meal within a meal that I'm giving to you so that after I die, which will be tomorrow, you will have something to sustain you. He knew that they were going to face hard times, even desperate times, and he knew that desperate times called for desperate measures. And so this meal that we call communion or the Lord's Supper, which began the last night of Jesus' life, is a way of feeding not so much physical hunger, although if you get a really big piece of bread, it might take the edge off a little. But it's a way of feeding our deepest spiritual hunger. Now, physical hunger is really easy to identify. Right? We have signs. Winnie the Pooh would say, there's a rumbly in my tumbly. You know, we get pangs, little contractions, little reminders of our body saying, hey, don't forget about me. Send food now. What are the signs, the indicators of spiritual hunger? They might be a little harder to pick up on. And you may have some of your own, but here are some that I've experienced and observed. Fear. Fear is a sign of spiritual hunger. Loneliness might be, isolation absolutely is. A sense of meaninglessness. The belief that if I don't do it, it's not going to get done. The weight of the world rests on my shoulders. It's a sign of spiritual hunger. Also, the flip of that. The belief that no matter what I do, it's not going to make a difference. It'll never be enough. I don't matter. Those are all signs of spiritual hunger. And spiritual hunger can ultimately only be satisfied by God. And there is no more concrete physical expression of God than in and as the person of Jesus. And this meal that we call communion is the most physical and personal presence of God, physical and personal presence of Jesus that we have available to us. And here's the difference between satisfying spiritual hunger and satisfying physical hunger. All those things that we talked about earlier that I said, you know, it really doesn't matter when you're hungry. Turns out they do matter when we're talking about spiritual hunger. Thinking about, food helps. It actually can enhance the experience. Luther, in talking about the Lord's Supper, communion, spends a lot of words encouraging people to come regularly and frequently to the meal. Because he had observed that people were avoiding it. And they were avoiding it for one of two reasons. Either they thought they didn't need it, or they thought they didn't deserve it. And they thought they didn't need it because Luther had actually been too effective in communicating that the real thing that mattered, the real thing that made this sacrament beneficial, was the belief that the promise that it contained was true. You tracking with me there? That's an important point. So the people then were able to separate belief from the experience of the meal. They said, I can believe with or without the meal, and so they would go extended periods of time without. And Luther found that it wasn't a matter of absence making the heart grow fonder. It was more out of sight, out of mind. The people became indifferent. So that's, I don't need it. I don't deserve it. You know, the church in Luther's time was very, very clear about, boy, if you don't get everything out on the table fully confessed, you know, you can't be right with God, and you don't deserve, you're not worthy of receiving. And that was part of what drove Luther to read the Bible and find God's promises. Well, if you think about it, who's ever worthy? Really, I mean, if that's the measure, is perfection, then nobody's ever worthy. And if you wait until you feel worthy, you're never going to come. So thinking about spiritual hunger and this meal that Jesus provides can actually enhance the experience. Also, remembering in this way can be a helpful and an enhancing thing. We talked about this last week as well. There are two kinds of remembering. You know, one is just recalling facts. Like, who played second base for the Cubs in 1969? That's just a recall of facts, right? And that would be Glenn Beckert for anyone who was going to be upset if he didn't know the answer to that. But there's a more powerful way of remembering that's more than recall. It's actually a participating in that past in the present. In our family, when it's the kids' birthdays, part of our tradition is we pull out the first year photo book. Remember photo books? Yeah, it's a book with pictures in it. Yeah. And we remember, you know, who these little people were, and how the world was brightened by their entrance in it. And we carry that forward, and we see who they're becoming, and we remember who they were and all that. And it's so remembering this addressing of spiritual hunger can also be really, really important. And how about the analysis of the elements themselves? You know, we're not breaking down protein and carbohydrate and stuff, but you know, for about 1,000 years, the church has tried to understand and argued points of view around how is it that bread and wine become the body and blood of Jesus. And so they'll get really specific. It's like, when is the precise moment and what are the means and what's the philosophical framework that will explain that in a clear and compelling and argument-winning for all time way? And guess what? For 1,000 years, all we've got is confusion and disagreement. Luther had a very, very pragmatic approach to that. He said, I believe Jesus' promise. He says, this is my body, this is my blood, that's good enough for me. The promise matters far more than the process. And we focus on that. The last two, the source What's the source of this meal? It's Jesus himself. This is my body. This is my blood. This is my meal. This is my promise. This is my presence. It's Jesus, 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 over and over and over. And finally, who pays for it? Well, you know who pays for it. I'm not talking about the line item in the church budget. Jesus pays for it with his life. Desperate times call for the most desperate of measures. He says, do this. It's a command. It's also an invitation. What happens when we do it? We receive the forgiveness of sin. And I'm not going to do a broad discourse on sin or forgiveness this morning, but this, I think, suffices. If we understand sin as to be anything that would separate us from God, forgiveness is God's presence in spite of that. It's God saying there is absolutely nothing that would stand between you and me. Nothing can separate us. And this meal is an embodiment of that reality. Where Jesus is present, sin is forgiven. So how do we then leave here? What happens in our lives when we have had this kind of closeness with Jesus? The Franciscan priest and writer Richard Rohr had a piece this week that I thought was really timely. And he's talking about how it is for him when God is especially close. God's always close, but when he senses God's closeness. He said, when I'm closest to God, I sense a deep okayness to life, despite all the contradictions. Somehow sadness and joy are able to coexist at the same time. And here's my favorite line. The negative value of things no longer cancels out the positive. I read that about 3 or 4 times. I'm only going to read it to you twice. The negative value of things no longer cancels out the positive, nor does the positive deny the negative. Our spiritual hunger is satisfied. This is my body given for you. This is my blood poured out for you. Do this and remember me. Amen.